This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi te motu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Mike Lawrence.
And we are.
And I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Mike, you've worked, among other things, you've worked in radio in Palmerston North, but your interest in that sort of thing started much earlier.
Yeah, as a small child, I think it started with my uncle, actually, who was a radio ham or radio amateur, and I used to love going into a shack and looking over his shoulder, seeing what he was doing, and him communicating with radio hams around the world, and that fascinated me.
Why are they called radio hams?
Just a abbreviation of amateur, I think.
Amateur?
Yeah,
H-A-M for amateur, okay. Amateurs. Okay, so what sort of age were you when you started? When are we looking at?
I suppose about 8 or 10. At the time, I was living in Invercargill. And I used to go along to the local radio station. They had a children's session at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and I used to like watching that. But most people would watch the presenter or announcer in one studio, but I was more interested in the control room next door with his mysterious black racks and people in dust coats.
So okay. Now we're talking about the late 1940s up to about 1950. If you were 8 or 10.
Correct.
And you said there was no television in New Zealand.
Oh, no.
But you said there were the children's programmes on the radio.
Yes, yes.
So what sort of things were
They were just children's stories. I don't remember them being a lot of recorded ones, but certainly in my case in Invercargill, the presenter, and interestingly, his name was Uncle Clary, because in those days, children knew adults, and certainly these children's presenters, they knew them by as either aunt or uncle. So in the Invercargill case, it was Uncle Clary who ran the session at 5 o'clock, and he would read stories or have somebody else in. There was one case, in fact, when he was doing a story which involved horses, so he got me to rattle a steel framed chair on the floor, which sounded like horse galloping, things like that. I don't remember there being many recorded stories like there are today.
Yeah.
But as I said, I was more interested in what was going on next door in the technical department.
Okay.
So after that, after we left Invercargill, we went to Napier, and again I was sticking my nose against the control room glass and seeing what was going on there.
Do you know why you were drawn to that side of things?
I was a practical sort of person, always have been a practical sort of person, and my uncle started me off, I guess, because he built me my very first radio, a crystal set in those days.
Okay.
And then I went on to having a one valve radio. So I decided that I would like to do that, and if I could get hold of a radio myself, and I did get hold of a radio which was quite popular in the day called Atwater Kent.
Yeah.
And I got hold of one of these and dismantled that. I never put it together again, but it was fun dismantling it.
There are stories like that. There's a genius took something apart and the parents were horrified. Don't worry, I can put it back together. So then another child took it apart and the parents, oh, it must be a genius, and couldn't think of it. Now, you mentioned crystal set. I don't know if young people today would know what that is.
No, they wouldn't. How do I describe this? It's a germanium. I think the crystal was a germanium one, and it had a very fine wire that touched it, and that was called a cat's whisker. And between the wire and the crystal, it formed what is called these days a rectifier. So with a long wire aerial attached to it, it would pick up, you could tune it to a radio station frequency, and it would receive that frequency and then it would be rectified into an audio signal, very, very faint, and you had to be have a fairly strong radio signal for it to work. But that's where a lot of kids started off their radio interest, was to build their own crystal sets.
So basically a very basic radio sort of structure.
Very basic, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And how big were they?
Oh, you know, only about three or 4 inches. There were very few components. There was only about maybe three or four components on the thing, and you had to have a pair of headphones. Very small.
Did they have to warm up in the same way?
Oh, no.
So you got the receptor straight away.
Yeah, they didn't even have a battery. They were just powered by the radio wave coming in.
Okay, yep. Okay, and so then you got onto the valve radio, which does have to warm up.
Yeah. That was a bit... it was interesting, but it had a few more components, and it also ran from a battery. I remember there was 67.5-volt battery, and they were expensive. So, you know, to replace batteries was a bit much for me.
So it wasn't plug-in? You wouldn't plug it into the wall?
No, it was battery-operated. And it had a we call them valves. The Americans call them vacuum tubes. Which had a filament in which was powered by the battery.
Were they reliable, or they tend to break quite often?
They're not as reliable as modern technology, put it that way.
Yeah.
Fairly reliable, but when I joined Broadcast, we'll come to that later on, all the technology there was valves, and that's why they had teams of technicians going around changing valves all the time.
Yeah, because the early televisions were all valve as well.
They were indeed.
Before transistors.
Yes.
Kind of.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so you were motivated into this. You took the radio apart.
Yep.
But you were not deterred by that, being unable to put it
back together. Right. I thought maybe I should learn about putting these things back together, I suppose. And that's when I had an interest in my career in radio. So it was a toss-up between being an avionics technician in NAC, which National Airways Corporation, which is the forerunner of today's Air New Zealand.
Yeah.
The other option was to join the Air Force.
Okay, because you would have had military service, did you?
No, I didn't. No, I managed to escape that. And then the third option was radio broadcasting. And so I had to make a decision in my final year in high school and decided that radio broadcasting was the way to go.
Okay.
So I put in a application to be a technical trainee.
Yeah.
And my local radio station was in Napier, but they didn't couldn't take on any trainees there, so I ended up in Wellington.
So you go straight from school into a job with where you're trained, a sort of apprenticeship in the job.
Yeah, the training was very good in those days. Broadcasting was the NZBS in those days, New Zealand Broadcasting Service, and they had their own training courses. They had obviously on-job training as well. And then there was correspondence training. In those days, there was the Correspondence Institute, the Correspondence Technical Institute, that's right.
Okay.
And so they would send out...
And all that was paid for you?
Yes.
So were you employed as an apprentice as such, or they just had a different term for it?
A technical trainee was my first designation, yes.
Okay. Now, one thing you didn't... You had this interest and you were doing it while you were still at school. Were any of your friends into that as well? Was it something that several of you got into?
No, not really. No, I was a bit of a loner in that respect. And so when I got home, I'd be away in the garage with whatever interested me. But no, my mates weren't into that sort of thing.
Yeah. And how did you fund it if you had to buy all the parts and things?
Well, I didn't fund. It was a case of robbing things that were maybe given to me, like an old radio or something like that. Yeah. I never really built anything. I just had this interest in, and I was interested at that stage, and we'll come to that, in listening to shortwave radio. And we happened to have an old valve shortwave radio, and I'd spend hours listening to it, tuning around to different shortwave stations around the world.
Because then the benefit of shortwave is what, like you say, around the world, you could it travels far more than
shortwave is a band of frequencies above the AM broadcast band that we have today, but below the FM broadcast band.
Okay.
And the benefit of shortwave radio is that it bounces away its way around the world. So from the transmitter on the other side of the world, the signal would go up to the ionosphere.
Yeah.
It would be reflected by that down to Earth again.
Yeah.
It would be reflected by the Earth back up to the ionosphere and down until it came to its destination, perhaps on the other side of the world.
Okay, yep.
And then shortwave, I don't think there's much happening in shortwave these days, but now we've got FM and UHF and all these other...
satellite stuff.
Right? Satellite stuff, exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So, and you got good reception around the world with that?
Yeah, well, that's when I joined, after I joined 2ZB in Wellington, I was there for only 6 months, and I stayed at the public service hostel in Oriental Bay, looking over the bay, and I didn't think of anything at the time, but now I go back there and I look, gee, I lived in Oriental Bay. And so I had this interest in shortwave radio, and broadcasting, was it still NZBS? Can't remember, might have been NZBC Corporation in those days, I can't remember. But they have had a shortwave receiving station at Macra, which is a few kilometres west of Karori. And in those days, we're talking about 1960, international communications was very difficult. There were submarine cables between countries, but the capacity on those was very limited. And if you made a telephone call, it was expensive. So they were largely used for telegraph, which in those days meant teleprinters. Or the other option was shortwave radio. So out in Macra, there were actually two shortwave receiving stations. One was the broadcasting one that I joined up with. The other one was owned by the post office. I can't remember if they were called the New Zealand Post Office at that stage. Before that, they were called the Post and Telegraph Department. So they had a receiving station there as well, which was quite interesting because if you made an international telephone call, obviously there's two paths. There's the listening path and there's the sending or transmitting path. So if you made an international phone call, you were connected to the International Exchange in Wellington. Your sending path would actually go up by landline to Himatangi, where they had a shortwave transmitting station. So that was the sending path, but the listening path came in through the Macra receiving station.
Wow, so it's not just going back and forth on the same...
No, you couldn't have the transmitting station in the same area as a receiving station because the power of the transmitting station would interfere with the signal on the receiving side. So they had to be quite separate. And the post office, as I said, had their transmitting side at Himatangi, their receiving site at Macra. But the radio station broadcasting, we're only interested in receiving radio station from overseas, so we only had a receiving station there.
Now, in your own personal intro, because you mentioned about ham radio, were you just interested in the receiving side or in the broadcast side as well?
I never became a radio ham. It was only I was interested in my uncle, who was a radio ham. I was interested in looking over his shoulder and seeing what he did, but I never became a radio ham myself.
Okay. Now, there's Tony Hancock had a very amusing episode about the radio ham, and he was connecting all over the world, but the conversations were really quite limited. Did you pick up with your uncle, if you were observing what he was doing, was it what's the weather like where you are, what's the something like that, or was there something more interesting? Was it exchange of ideas or just the enjoyment of contact with people in different countries?
Well, these radio hams, of course, they're interested because they built their own equipment most of the time. Mm. In fact, that was the only way of getting equipment, was to build it yourself.
Yeah.
So they would talk about their equipment, how they built it and so on. But they might talk about their wives. It was interesting because before voice communications, there was Morse code, dots and dashes and so on. And so because of that, everything had to be abbreviated. So if you wanted to talk about your girlfriend, well, you wouldn't spell out girlfriend in Morse code. It would be far too long. So they called them YLs, young ladies.
Okay.
So they translated into voice technician, and they say, how's your YL today, or your YF, or wife? And so it had all these abbreviations.
Can I take it from that this was predominantly a male sphere?
Oh, yes.
Any women involved at all, do you know?
I don't recall any, no.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Like
They were inside making the meals.
Yeah, probably something that'd appeal more to the to the male psyche, the technology of it.
Yeah.
So Okay. So now you were starting to talk about the work that you were doing and the involvement in that.
Right. Well, when I was at 2ZB. A lot of that time was training, going on courses, doing correspondence course, and of course the on-station training as well. When I went out to the shortwave receiving station at MACRA, of course that training continued because it took me quite a few years to get qualified, and I wasn't very good at that. But the shortwave receiving station was a 24-hour operation, eight-hour shifts over 24 hours. So I could be working a day shift, or I could be working from 1 in the morning till 8 in the morning. And because the source of news was really restricted to shortwave radio, newspapers could get theirs by teleprinter. So that could be over submarine cables, and they just get printed out on paper and so on. But in the case of broadcasting, we got our news from other radio stations, overseas radio stations. The main one was the BBC, and we always had the BBC tuned up 24 hours a day. And that was a job in itself, because the shortwave radio, as I said before, with radio waves reflecting from the ionosphere, that ionosphere changes during the day. Some days it may be a good path for shortwave, other times it might not be. So there was a lot of selecting the best frequency for the BBC, and that was sent on landline to Broadcasting House in Wellington, to the newsroom there, and they would listen or record or do whatever.
So this was coming in as audio, not Morse code?
Correct. Very definitely so.
Yeah.
So there's the BBC, there's the ABC in Australia, the Voice of America in United States, and All India Radio, just about any country that was interesting, we'd tune up around the world.
So in those countries, there'd be something happening, they'd condense it down to broadcast a news item to come through to you, and it'd be condensed down further for the New Zealand public?
No. The news wasn't designed for our use in New Zealand. It was a...
News as for Britain or the United States, whatever.
Yeah.
And then you'd pick bits out so it would be narrowed down even more on some of those.
That's right. So, the BBC had news bulletins every hour on the hour.
Okay.
So we had to, we would record those, but at the same time it would be sent on a landline. The audio would be sent on a landline to Broadcasting House.
Yes.
So if they wanted to, if they missed out on something, then they could call, fall back on our recording of it, and we'd play that to them.
Okay. So did you feel then? Well, what, had you travelled overseas at all?
No.
Okay. Because I was wondering, did you feel that maybe New Zealanders weren't too well informed about what's happening in the rest of the world?
That could well be the case. Yes. I mean, we obviously had the strong relationship with the United Kingdom. So I think the majority of people were more interested in that than they were for North America, for example. But things happened in North America. One thing, 19, I can't remember the year now, but I was on a night shift, and I was due to knock off at 8 o'clock, and at 7 o'clock I was tuning up different stations for the newsroom in Wellington. And about quarter to 7 I heard news flash. I pricked up my ears because we were tuned to listen for news flashes and phone up the newsroom if any came through.
Yeah.
Normally they were just births of royal babies and that sort of thing. But in this case, it turned out to be that President Kennedy had been shot. So I heard that and rang up the newsroom and said, listen to this, it's President Kennedy's been shot.
Am I right in thinking then you were the first person in New Zealand to have that?
I'm sure I was.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that it could have got to New Zealand any quicker.
Yeah, yeah. Would there be other sort of amateurs in New Zealand listening into those things as well, or they wouldn't have the equipment?
They wouldn't be listening to ordinary broadcast stations. They'd be listening to each other, their own amateur chat.
Okay,
So, after that incident, I stayed on duty for a while, and we tuned up and got as much news as we could for that.
Okay.
And then a few days later, I was rostered on to cover the funeral service, which was broadcast live on 2YA.
Now your focus for all of this is the broadcast information, but there'd be a lot more in newspapers. So did overseas newspapers come through, or how did they come through to New Zealand?
Well, in the early days of the... This was before the broadcasting, whether it was NZBC or RNZ. I don't think it was RNZ in those days. NZBC, before they established their own news service, they just had a couple of people that came in at the end of the day, or they might have come in early in the day. They didn't have a proper news service as such. So an interesting thing was that an important source of the news in Wellington was the Evening Post.
Yes.
So a journalist would come in at, they had a regular 9 p.m. News bulletin. So a journalist would come in about 7 o'clock, read the Evening Post, and get their stories from there, and that was about the only source, perhaps supplemented by something from the shortwave.
So there wasn't the sort of editorial group saying what comes first, and say it's just the person just picks out.
You just fly by the seat of your pants.
Okay. So you'd have picked up probably that. Were you involved in that, or you're more the technical side?
Technical side.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
So it could be very selective as to what the New Zealand public got to hear about.
Oh, yes. Yes, there's no competition on broadcasting. No competition at all.
Yeah. So, except this is what they talk about, competition in newspapers and so on. The radio is also competing with newspapers and magazines and so on. It's a broader market in that way, and you probably get more in-depth coverage with newspapers and maybe even more local coverage in the early days, because there wouldn't have been local radio stations with their own news gathering. Would that have happened at all?
Not until later in the piece. No, in the early days, so 1960s, it was very, very basic news. I can't even remember whether radio stations had their own local news bulletins.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't have had their own journalists, that's for sure, until later in the piece. And I can't remember what year it was, late 1960s perhaps, when Radio New Zealand, NZBC, whatever, started up their news service, fully-fledged news service, and put journalists around the country.
Yeah. So the local stations, were all state-owned as well? Was any private?
No, the... my only experience with a private station was in Palmerston North. I came to Palmerston North in 1974, and 2ZA, as it was known then, was the only station in the area. It was government-owned, and it was only a few years later that 2XS came along and created some competition for 2ZA. So then 2ZA had to pull their socks up and...
Okay, so that's sort of mid-70s you started to get private radio stations.
I came to Palmerston North in 1974, so be late 70s, I think. I haven't got the exact date when 2XS started up, but probably late 70s.
Now I'm trying to. I'm from Britain, and there were the pirate radio stations offshore. Yeah. New Zealand had, was it Radio Hierarchy?
That's right. Yes, because broadcasting was very strictly controlled in those days, all government controlled, and you couldn't just go on there with a radio station and start broadcasting. Yeah. But a band of people up Auckland way thought, well, to hell with this. We'll do it, but we'll go offshore. We'll go outside the territorial limit on a boat and transmit from there.
Mm.
And that's how Radio Hauraki started. Yeah. They came to grief because their boat sank at one stage. But then they did. They transferred to land-based station and have thrived since.
Mm. Yeah,
and they were the forerunners of the private stations.
Okay, so working in radio in those days, was it already established, or did it feel like a pioneer type activity?
Well, radio had been established in Palmerston North, I believe. It goes back to about 1928.
Yeah. Okay.
When I think it was Manawatu Radio Club. It was a band of people, males of course, were interested in starting a local radio station. So they had a public meeting of people who were interested in having a local radio station. So they started up. I can't remember much details about that. And then the government came along with a radio station, and that was in the TNG building in Broadway.
Were they a bit worried about private sector and thought we better control this because we don't know what would come out otherwise?
Well, at that stage, there was... I don't know how private radio was going around New Zealand at that stage before the government put clamps on it and stopped any more development of radio stations.
Yeah. And very briefly, because we're nearly at time, but what sort of programmes were broadcast? Was it sort of music, chat, interview, cooking... You've got children's programs, but
a mixture of everything. There was the breakfast session, which was heavily commercialised, and that involved technicians as well as announcers, because the announcers did the speaking and read advertising scripts, but there was a lot of recorded material as well on vinyl discs, and the technician in the control room was kept busy playing these 30-second. Or 60-second commercials as it went on. Okay, so after that, typically, there would be a morning program, a shopping reporter program, which was paid advertising, basically. Shopping reporter would talk about...
This was private radio station?
No, I'm talking about 2Z.
The government radio station would have a lot of commercial material?
Yeah, they had a variety of stations... The commercial stations had were the Z class, like 2ZA. Yes, okay. The non-commercial ones were Ys, like 2YA in Wellington. Okay. And then there was the middle one, the X class, like Whanganui. They had, I can't remember, 2X something, C perhaps, and they were a bit of both. Some of the day was commercial and the other part of the day was non-commercial.
This is part one of three. Listen next week for part two. Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.